Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Ecclesiastes chapter 2, Man's Search for Meaning. This actually began earlier in chapter 1, so we'll have to look back just a little bit. Remember, we're studying this book, Kohelet, the Preacher. The main themes are found in the search for meaning, the lifelessness or the meaninglessness of life. And the phrases that are major are, all is vanity, and tachat hashamayim, under the sun. Those are the key phrases. That word prophet again, yitron, is only used in the book of Ecclesiastes. And striving after wind. Ureut ruach, striving after wind. Well, I almost feel like we should leave God out as we unpack this. I talked to a fellow this week about the book of Ecclesiastes and said, it's so raw and it's so desperately despondent. If you read this with the way that it was intended, if you read it with Solomon's ache on his back, if you hear Solomon's angst, we could call it Solomon's angst. That could be a new name for Ecclesiastes. Then you know that he is in pain. And if you read this from a man who should know better, he's the wisest man on the earth, richest man, given himself to all kinds of simchas, and he is hopeless. How does that leave you? And I want to tell you that this friend of mine who told me that he had heard a sermon series on this told me that the man from whom he heard it didn't mention the last chapter until the last chapter. That he left it stark every week, I don't know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, however long he preached this, because the book itself leaves you hopeless. It is a great case for suicide. The problem is people don't keep coming back, and some who are listening tonight or today online may find that it's so hopeless they don't want to listen to next week's talk, and so they won't find out there really is hope. But if you were like this man who talked to me this week, part of a community of faith where you kept listening and you came back week after week, then you would hear finally the good news at the end. I suppose when we think about the reality of the estimation of life, that we could get similarly despondent. I don't know if you saw or read a little something that I put up. I actually put it up on the window, surrounded by some photos of the magazine Vanity Fair. I put it up in the window so that people who aren't here in our class can read along with us. Here's what I say. We are studying the book of Ecclesiastes, vanity of vanities, all is vanity under the sun, in our weekly Bible class. How apropos is this evaluation by Malcolm Muggeridge, then? Here's what Muggeridge says. British. Whereas other civilizations have been brought down by attacks of barbarians from without, ours had the unique distinction of training its own destroyers at its own educational institutions, and then providing them with facilities for propagating their destructive ideology far and wide, all at the public expense. Thus did Western man decide to abolish himself, creating his own boredom out of his own affluence, creating his own vulnerability out of his own strength, his own impotence out of his own erotomania, himself blowing the trumpet that brought down the walls of his own city, and having convinced himself that he was too numerous, labored with pill and scalpel and syringe to make himself fewer, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility and polluted and drugged himself into stupefaction, he keeled over, a weary, battered old brontosaurus, and became extinct. Malcolm Muggeridge from Religion and Society. If that doesn't describe what the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying, then I'm not reading it right. It's exactly what Solomon was writing as an old man, a frustrated old guy who was not happy with anything that had previously been titled life. Now, what they did and what we do today are of different sorts, but they are of similar sorts. Let's look at the similarities as we unpack this text. we see that he gave himself to Simcha. Now, when we hear that in modern days, we are hearing a joyful celebration like a bar mitzvah or a baptism. But here he's saying, no, this is clearly an idea of what we would call pleasure. Every kind of pleasure there is. It's almost as if you walk down the marketplace and it is like Vanity Fair, and you are offered by advertising and by people. Sometimes, I mean, you've gone in various cities around the globe and you will find people offering all kinds of things on the street corner, themselves or the latest strawberry or beautiful cakes, tulips, any number of things. I think of the beginning of the show Oliver. That was a great show, wasn't it? And you see all the different people selling in that London scene all their things. In other words, if you want something, all you need is money to buy it, and you can have anything you want. You could get probably a packet of John Travolta's toenails if you wanted in New York City. I mean, you can get anything anywhere if you pay enough for it. What did I see just a couple weeks ago? They were selling an original house and land, John Lennon's house or Paul McCartney's home. I mean, it was a nowhere house in Liverpool, a terrible estate. It's not an estate, it's just a dive. But because it had their name on it, people were paying upwards of, well, tons, £800,000 or something. Unbelievable expense for something that is valuable. Well, I'd say it's just a piece of property that has memory. So come now, I will test you with pleasure. I said this to myself. I said to myself, to my own heart, I'm speaking to my heart. Now that could sound like a schizophrenic, but it really is a self-evaluator. I think that's an important part of our life. By the way, I said that Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon as an old man. When he was a young man, we see that he wrote Song of Songs. When he was of age, he wrote Proverbs when he was at the peak of his wisdom. But he wrote Kohelet as an old man, a bit cynical, a bit tired, a bit snarky, not happy with his existence and what others would call life. So he tested himself with all this simcha, all this joyful stuff. And he tells himself, which is kind of weird, to enjoy yourself, and it's all just hevel. It's all vanity. What's his pleasure? What does he explore? Laughter, verse 2. More simcha, what does it accomplish? How to stimulate, that's the mashach of his body, really his basar, his flesh, with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely. So he's stimulating his mind. He's taking classes at the university, at the free university. He's studying Kabbalah, right? Because isn't that part of learning cool stuff? He's trying to get not just academic information, to which everyone can ascribe a title of truth, but he's looking for mystery religions. He's looking for mystery information. He's trying to get cool stuff to learn. He's digging deeper. What I'm saying is, if Solomon were living today, he'd be going to Kabbalah classes. He'd be taking New Age information. He'd be going up to the Blue Mountains and sitting with a Buddhist monk and trying to gain new stuff. All the other religions that are out there. I mean, and you want to study that so you can be well informed. You want to know. So what do the Greeks call that? It was Gnostic information. They wanted to know the deeper things. And the simple truths of the scripture and the simple truths of God sound monotonous to people. So they're trying to find something more. He is exploring with his mind. He's exploring with his body. Look what he did. Verses 4 through 8 or so, we get this phrase that's repeated again, again, and again. The redundancy of the "for myself" section stresses that he invested himself in this experiment. He was not alone, but he really gave himself to it. And another way to see it is that he did this for himself, so that let the whole world go to hell in a basket. I want something to satisfy myself, and I'm not finding it. So it's almost the sound of a desperate guy. Do you feel that? Do you feel his desperation? I enlarged my works, the things that I built. What do we know that he built? The temple. That's pretty massive in itself. Gardens.
Empire.
Okay, good. The largest stretch of Israel in ever, in its day, is under Solomon. Yeah, all these wives and all these were like marriages of convenience to stretch the kingdom westward to Ethiopia and eastward to what became Persia. You get this breadth and height. You get this notion that we've got to get more. The accumulation of stuff. And we say, oh, Solomon, what's wrong with you? Don't we do the same thing? Don't we say in modern days, if I could just have a little more, then my life would be happier? If I could just get more hours at work, if I could just get more money per hour, if I could get more people liking me, if I could get more stuff in my apartment, if I could get more room and have a house, then I could have more stuff and I could have more happiness. And we start to identify wrong things to give ourselves pleasure. So I enlarged my works, built houses. That's true. There are so many famous buildings. You can see that in 1 Kings chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. You see him building stuff. Planted vineyards. We talk about the famous Hanging Gardens, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, Hanging Gardens of Babylon. And there were other places where the famous gardens were. Building parks and gardens, it is standard. Have you been to France? Have you seen beautiful gardens built to this king or this emperor? They had those everywhere, and it is customary when a new emperor in Italy or in Austria-Hungary. These famous gardens that were there were not just decorative and a place for the riffraff, but it really was a place for himself and his family. You've been to the Alhambra in Granada? An amazing facility, and this was in Germany. You'll see it across the Middle East. You'll see it all kinds of places. It's expensive. It's lavish. It is for yourself. It's for your people, but it's really as a self-tribute. That's what he's doing, gaining self-honor, as if that's going to do anything for him. Made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. So it wasn't just a single tree. I think of the beauty of Canberra and how in the 30s, Burley Griffin, the American who came in and planted all kinds of trees that makes it into a stunning place. They knew exactly where to find to match the edaphic factor with the trees, and it's stunning, especially in autumn. It's really beautiful. So that's probably something that Solomon would have done, planted the things in the right places. He made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. In other words, I was not only building something for today, I was building something for tomorrow. I'm going to take care of things. And it is appropriate in a desert like Israel is to have an irrigation system. And then, of course, you have to stock it. You have to stock it with trees, you have to stock it with water, and you have to stock it with servants. So what did he do? He bought male slaves. He bought female slaves. And I had home-born slaves. The kids of slaves is more literal. B'nai Bayit. And he possessed flocks and herds larger than everyone who preceded me in Jerusalem. In other words, you think those guys were wealthy. They didn't even come up to my ankles in the wealth that I had. Flocks and herds are demonstrable. How do you feed flocks and herds? You've got to have grassland, which means you've got to irrigate, which means you've got to have gardens, which means so you're not just having this lavish self-proclamation. You've got acres and hectares and thousands of acres of grassland where your herds and flocks can have bounty, and you've got to have slaves to tend to them. So everything mounts on top of itself as a tribute to Solomon's wealth. But remember, wealth is just something by the which we buy stuff. Every day on the news, they tell us how much the Australian dollar is worth. And they compare it against the Japanese yen, against the American greenback, against the British pound, sometimes against the Kiwi dollar. And then if you read all the stock pages and all the bonds, you can spend hours reading and determining where you should invest your dollar, your $5,000, or your squizillions of millions of dollars. At the end of the day, all you're going to get for all that is more work and more paper and more evaluation, because once you start getting money, then you want to get more money. They talk about people who buy lottery tickets, that the ones who are the happiest, in fact, the only ones who are happy at all, who win, because some win. I've never won. You've never won. The only thing that makes people happy who win is if they go back to work the next day. If they don't go back to work, then they're always going to be chasing more luxury cars or more luxury boats or more trips to some unaffordable location. The whole point of gaining it is to serve other people, but that's not the plan for every lottery winner at the Irish sweepstakes, right? Or the New York or Boston lottery or the Powerball that we see every night on TV. Those are useless games. You will never win, and if you do win and you don't serve people, you still have lost. That may be the best thing that Solomon is teaching us, because all that money is a medium of exchange, where you take what is attributed value and go buy something else that's attributed to be that value. You want to buy the latest iPad? It costs, what does it cost? $500? I don't know, I'm just guessing. So you got to have $500. So $500 isn't worth anything unless you go trade it in for something that somebody has esteemed is valuable. You want the iPad. Why do you want the iPad? So you can compute things, so that you can play Angry Birds, so that you can communicate with friends. Can't we do that on the things that we already have? So why do you want the latest and greatest? Oh, I've just got to have the latest socks and the most beautiful shoes. Pardon me, women. You got to have the latest shoes. And look, and you stop. I don't know why I'm walking. I'm on holiday with any woman that I'm walking with, my wife, my daughters, my sister, my it doesn't matter who it is. And we walk by a shoe store. We slow down. We slow down and we look. And I'm not looking. I don't care. Tell me, honestly, do the shoes all begin to look alike after a while? But to a woman, they don't look alike. So I just have to realize I'm not made the same. But this accumulation of stuff, which Malcolm Muggeridge was identifying as affluence, could lead us, what did he say? We created our own boredom out of our own affluence. That so describes it. The more you gain, the more you want. And the more you want, the more unhappy you are. So gaining isn't anything. Losing isn't anything either. I mean, it's no great pleasure to be poor. It's no great honor to have nothing and to always be begging. We have people who come in the shop here, and I know most religions that have an office have people who come in who want, you know, some free McDonald's coupons, or they want some handout. I appreciate that. I mean, I know it's a tough gig if you don't have anything. I had a guy come in today, an Israeli, looking for a job. I applaud that. It's great. Problem is, he's on a tourist visa. You can't work on a tourist visa. So he's looking for a job under the table. Yeah. So look what Solomon did. I collected, verse 8, for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. So he got all the stuff, silver, gold, and treasures. There's nothing he didn't have. His bank account was full. And then look what he did. Provided for himself male and female singers. So he had dinner with the symphonic orchestra and people from the conservatorium singing quartet music. He had everything a man could want. In fact, he says, and then he defines it, the pleasures of men, many concubines. I don't know if that's the only pleasures of men. By the way, it's a different Hebrew word than the simcha, this tanug. Many concubines. In other words, not just one. He had any woman he wanted. What do you want? He's got everything he wants. So I titled last week, The Sameness, The Monotony of Life. But tonight, Searching for Meaning, I call it Trivial Pursuits. Because whatever these pursuits are to which anyone ascribes or prescribes or suits up and goes for, anything that we want, it's just trivial. Tuesday was a pretty big day in Australia. Melbourne Cup, a horse race that stops the nation. It, by the way, didn't stop me. That's when I went over and saw Ezra. A horse race. We walked down the street. Eddie and I walked down, and we got the car, and then we drove over to the hospital. And everywhere we went, we saw people stand. We saw the backs of people. What were they doing? They were looking at a TV. Everywhere. Inside the hospital, every floor was basically abandoned. And patients and nurses and doctors all together were in every sitting room that was available. Every office was empty except for people looking at a TV screen because, you know, they had the office pool and we've got to cheer our number 7 or number 13 or whatever it was. This is the most trivial thing I think I've ever seen. When a hospital dedicated to supporting people is spending its time eating, drinking, and being merry and abandoning their post, albeit, okay, to be fair, for 7 minutes or 3 minutes or 19 minutes or however long they did it. But I thought, this is a perfect time to bomb the city. This is a perfect time to go in and steal from a bank. This is a perfect time to do whatever you want because people are not watching. They're watching one thing. And why are they watching it? It's a thing. I get it. But all these pleasures are trivial pursuits. And how'd that work out for you, Solomon? What did he get at the end? He, verse 9, became great. That's simple gadol. And increased more than all who preceded me. My wisdom also stood by me. He had everything and every being and every possibility. Whatever I wanted, verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them. I didn't withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward. So I got anything I wanted. I got any person. I got any substance. I got any location, property, pleasure. I had it all. I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, all the work, that's maaseh, the work my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted. And by the way, I don't know that he exerted much. I don't think Solomon did a lot. I think he had workers who worked for him, and he counts all that. And he said, all of that was hevel. Every bit of everything that I strove for was a waste of time. How do you feel when you hear that? Summarize that for me. No profit under the sun. You're 80 years old. You're 60 years old. You're 70 years old. And you've wasted your whole life. How does that feel? I played golf yesterday with a fellow. I'd never met him before. We got merged together at the starter. And he was recently retired. He sold his company. He had 24 workers. A lovely guy, a North Shore guy. I said, so what are you doing now? He said, I've got to find something to do. I said, what are you talking about? He's 70 years old, and he's fairly fit. He said, I can't play golf all the time. I got to do something. And he said, I've got to contribute. That's just the word he used. So he's going to St. Vincent de Paul's. He's going to volunteer. He's going to try to do something to help the world. And that, I think, is reasonable and right. But I think Solomon would say, even that is vanity. See, we attribute value and say, oh, that'd be good. That'd be something worthwhile. Solomon would say, whatever you call good, whatever you call bad, it doesn't matter. It's all worthless under the sun. In the natural, without God, everything which you call life is meaningless. How horrible would it be to get to the end of your life and have a meaningless life, to have defined everything you sought and lived for as empty? And you want to say, no, really, there's something. He'd say, what? Tell me, really, what? He'd say, well, maybe you could go serve the poor. He'd say, I've done that. Maybe you could find another woman. Maybe you just need the right woman. Yeah, I've had 700 of those. And, you know, with every one, you get a mother-in-law, so come on. He's tried everything, and he's found it wanting. Now, that stands in stark, you called it tragic. I think that's a great word, tragedy, against what we would consider. You ask anybody walking down Oxford Street, hey, if you had, and we could calculate the amount of money he had in modern terms. Say you had $60 trillion. How would that do for you? Would that be all right? If I gave you a check for $60 trillion, could you handle that? If I gave you 700 wives or 300 wives, 700 concubines, would that be all right if you had all the women you wanted, fellas? And if I gave you all these gardens and beautiful houses to live in, you could have a house in Balmain, you could have a house in Switzerland and a house in Bahrain and in Mozambique. Would that be all right for you? You could have your own private jet. You could have your own heliport, your own helicopter. How'd that? Would that be all right? And I don't know a person, with whom I could speak who would say, no, I'd still need something more. I think most everybody would say, woo, lay it on me, Jose. I mean, this would be great, right? But Solomon is testimony that that's not so good. And that's what you have to embrace. I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and it was a waste. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. Maybe I could sort that out. And I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. But at the end, verse 14, one fate befalls them both. You know, it's the sameness, the monotonousness of the earth is going to last forever. If sun rises, sun falls, I don't know. Wise guys come along, fools come along, but at the end, they're all going to die. One fate befalls them both. So I said, well, why have I been wise? You know, what's the point of doing things wisely? If I could just live as an idiot and get the same ending that the idiots get, why should I be so smart? Why should I live a wise existence, choosing wise things? We're all going to die. What a waste. And nobody remembers you anyway, verse 16. Ein Zichron. There's no memory that's going to last. The wise man is with the fool, you know. They're both going to die, and they're neither going to be remembered. So my summary of life, I hate it. Verse 17, I hate life. It's all grievous. It's all painful. Now, he uses the word ra, which means evil, but I've read a lot of commentators who said, yeah, don't do that. It's more like lucky and unlucky. It's more like not good and evil with a moral attribution, but rather, it's just the way things are. Sometimes, you know, you get lucky, and there's a gal I know who lives in the neighborhood who stepped off the footpath onto the street to put her groceries away. She was a very active lady. She's 33, 34 years old. Very active, plays soccer, dances, goes to ballroom type dancing, and stepped off the footpath onto the curb, twisted her foot, and has been in a pseudo cast for about 4 months. It's the quirkiest little thing. She just twisted her ankle just a little bit. Is there a fracture there? I don't know. But it'd be like Solomon would say, there you go. Why bother? The same luck of the Irish, right? The same, that's just the way it is. It's going to hit you. It's Murphy's Law. It's just the way it's going to be. Things are going to go down on you, and they're not going to be good. I hate my life, he said. Everything's futility. Everything is hevel. Everything. And striving after wind. So I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I'd labored. So here I was. I produced stuff. I even hate the stuff I produced. Because not only were the actions bad or a waste of time, but so were the results of those. So I planted things, and what came out? Big deal. Now you and I would say, look at those mangoes. Look at those green beans. I mean, this is gorgeous. This is great. This will feed a lot of people. It'll feed me. This will feed my kids. This is great. He'd say, yeah, big deal. Big deal because you eat and then you're going to die. See, so he sees not only his labors, but the results of his labors as a waste of time. This is vanity. This, my friends, is tragic. So I completely despaired of all my labor. And what does he get, anyway? At the end of his days, verse 23, his task is painful and grievous. Even at night, his mind doesn't rest. You can't even sleep. You wake up, you have bad dreams, you go to sleep, you toss, you turn, hopeless. Life is meaningless. That's what he's saying. Verse 24, nothing better than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. Tell you what, live in folly. Live in delusion. Live in the moment. Yeah, live in delusion. Because tell you what, it's all a waste of time. So go ahead and tell yourself it's going to be good. And eat and drink and be merry because that's the best you got. That's all you're going to have. That feeling you have right now, it's going to turn to emptiness. But for right now, go ahead, delude yourself. This is his comfort to his grandchildren and to you and to me who are reading this. Should we lace this with, but read chapter 12, read chapter 12, it's all good at the end? Or should we let ourselves hear the stark reality of a man who knew better, who turned away from God, and who has an emptiness to sum up his life? I think we'll just let him continue to speak. Now listen, you come back next week and we'll keep talking. To everything there's a season. Come back next week. Verse 25 is this little slip-in summary that tells us that it's about God. It reinforces this recommendation about accepting the pleasures of life. This really does underscore that God is numero uno. Who can eat and have enjoyment without God? Who can do that? Nobody, right? So he says, to a person who's good in his sight, he's given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner, he's given the task of gathering and collecting so that he too may give to one who's good in God's sight. This too is vanity. Now the proverb says that the sinners are gathering for the wise. And so you hear a reflection of that. Solomon wrote both. But his summary of that collection for the wise is vanity, because he's so disparaging of life and discouraged in his life because he's abandoned God himself. When you don't live for God, then no matter what else you gain, you got nothing. When you don't live for God, whatever else you gain, you've got nothing. Or as Yeshua said, to him who has, even more will be given, but to him who is not faithful, if you're not faithful, even what you have will be taken away from you. So the question is not how much or what you have, but what you do with what you have. And Solomon, in his lavish, effusive, self-pitying sorrow, says it doesn't matter what you do with it. The Bible, the rest of the way, says if you use it well for the purposes of God, you'll find pleasure beyond all these pleasures that he had. These were trivial pursuits, and it brought him to a life that's meaningless. We should do better.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.